and welcome to the second episode of the Confluence Mailbag Podcast. I'm Bill O'Grady, Advisory Director at Confluence Investment Management. Joining me today, as always, is Mark Keller, CEO and CIO of Confluence. The idea behind this podcast is to replicate the question and answer sessions from the A.G. Edwards Investment Strategy Committee's open mic sessions from earlier this century. As a reminder, to submit questions, email us at mailbag@confluenceim.com. That's mailbag@confluenceim.com. Each month, we select 4 to 5 of the most common, provocative, and interesting questions we receive, and Mark and I address them. So without further ado, let's tackle the first one. Question comes in, what is the single greatest threat to the upward trend in the stock market over the next 3 years? I'll start on this one, Mark. I think in this particular time frame, the biggest concern I have is a complete breakdown in the U.S.-China relationship. China and the U.S. economy are almost in a mutually assured destruction situation. China is an export and investment-driven economy that struggles if it can't export and it can't invest. And its primary target of sending out its exports has been the United States. The U.S. initially, in fact, for a long time, welcomed these imports. It held down inflation and improved consumption. But over the past decade or so, there's been a retrenchment on this. And the Trump administration is taking increasingly aggressive steps to try to break China's ability to export to the United States. And although China is rapidly shifting its exports to other parts of the world, Europe and the emerging economies, there's no way that these other areas of the world can replace American consumption. Meanwhile, the U.S. remains vulnerable to China, not just for many basic goods. It's also the financial markets are dependent upon China sending its saving to the U.S. One of the exercises I've done recently is just to plot the U.S. 10-year yield against the exchange value of the Chinese yuan, and it was a remarkably strong fit. In other words, when the Chinese yuan devalues, the yield on the 10-year goes up. Reason this happens is that if you're an emerging market economy and you're trying to keep your exports competitive and China weakens its currency, you have to weaken yours too. And the way you do that is you sell treasuries out of reserve to try to drive your currency down and consequently drive the dollar higher. Longer term, past 3 years, what I worry about the most is that we get a shift in the labor capital balance. U.S. policy has been skewed toward capital since 1980, and after the Berlin Wall fell, it became positive toward capital in an even bigger way. And a reversal of these policies would have a strongly negative effect on financial asset values. And in the stock market, it would simultaneously compress margins and lower multiples. So we have some evidence of that. But so far, policy in general remains still pretty friendly to capital.
I agree with you on the China one, Bill. I think that's a single greatest threat right now. I'll toss another one out there that is beginning to worry me, something that usually doesn't cause a rapid conclusion to a bull market, but it has in the past sometimes done it. That's the bond market. What do I mean by that? Well, we're all, you know, listen, nobody in Washington seems to worry about deficit spending. Well, the party out of power always complains about it, but it's disingenuous because as soon as they get in power, they start spending money like mad and making the deficit bigger. And, you know, frankly, rarely has the bond market really exercised a lot of discipline on Washington. You know, well, we're seeing that the British bond market do that right now to the current government. It did it to the last one too, but we haven't seen the U.S. bond market do that. And I don't, you know, generally worry about the fiscal situation until it is a threat to the stock market, until things get extreme. But you could kind of see how things could get extreme here and have see a sharp upward move in treasury rates. It isn't generally a huge threat unless the stock market is really expensive. Oh, well, That's kind oops. Of, yeah, oops. we have that. A really sharp upward move in interest rates, 10 years and out especially, can catch Wall Street off guard. And this is exactly the situation we saw in the mid-80s. We saw the PE on the S&P go from high single digits to about 20 within 5 years. A very similar kind of situation we've seen here since the bottom in COVID. And the PE is even higher. We're probably 24, 25 times forward earnings right now on the S&P. If the government tries to control the long end of the curve, as they did with UE, and particularly if they exercise financial repression, something you've written about extensively, they may be able to keep everything kind of moving as they are. But what we saw back in 87 was the bond market, which had been strong, peaked in August, I believe, of that year, and sold off really sharply. The stock market pretty much ignored it for about 2 months. And then all of a sudden, bang, it caught up very quickly. The competition from yields got very strong very fast. And then we just saw all kinds of technical factors drive the market down very sharply and very quickly. I'm not predicting that in the near term, but conditions are right for it. I don't think the bond market has sold off enough recently to cause that, but I would be concerned if yields on long treasuries were to move up into the mid fives or higher. I think that would represent a pretty meaningful threat to the bond market, to the stock market.
I tend to agree with you. I don't think it's imminent. And the one other important caveat in the historical comparison to 87 is in 87, the Fed and the Treasury pretty much ran it straight. You know, when William Mcheskey Martin, you know, established monetary policy in its modern form in 1951, the idea was you'd let the long end kind of dictate to you what people were feeling. That has changed. We now see both the Treasury and the central bank attempting to manipulate the long end. The multiple rounds of QE over the last 15 years, the Treasury under Yellen skewing borrowing toward T-bills, means that I think they will take steps to prevent the long end from yield from rising a whole lot, which means that instead of the long end becoming the boogeyman, it's probably going to be something else. If I had to guess, it's probably the dollar. I'm not really sure a weak dollar could bring down the S&P.
Mm-hmm. And you're right about that. And we're also seeing Treasury and bank regulators taking steps to loosen lending requirements, bank, you know, capital requirements, et cetera, on the banking industry. Why? Because I think they want them to buy treasuries.
Yeah, I think.
And they want greater demand for treasuries. Let's face it, banks aren't lending a lot to American business anyway right now. They want the banks to become the next big buyer of treasuries. And yeah, I agree with you. They're going to take all kinds of steps to prevent my worry from coming to pass. But, you know, regulators don't always get what they want.
No, that's right. And you know, there's always this concern that no matter how hard they try, the market could overwhelm them. And that's a distinct possibility. I don't know. I think they just have a lot of tools at their disposal. Mm-hmm. And in 87, they were still running things as that, well, we let the long end go where it wants to, and it did. And I was working in the industry at that time, and you were too. And I was working in banking, and one of my favorite anecdotes from that period was that a lot of the older people I worked with, you know, had money saved, and a lot of them had money at one of the big discounters. And after the crash, they were all calling trying to liquidate their portfolios, and they could never get through. And finally, the portfolio started to recover, and we had the first buy the dip. And it turned out later, apparently all these firms just took their phones off the hook because mm-hmm. they couldn't handle the call volume, and it ended up saving investors. But, you know, one of the problems that's developed is that now we have created this buy the dip mentality, and mm-hmm. and now it's like dips barely give you a chance to get in. And I think my fear is one of these times you're going to get a dip and it's going to keep dipping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was in doing sell side research in the brokerage industry, so I was in this, you know, on this side of the street back then, and it was 48 years after the 1929 crash, which sounds like a long time, but there were people my age in the business who, for which that was still a living memory.
They were old.
They were old. They had gray hair and old, and they limped. Yeah. I am.
Probably
right
smoked
now.
Too.
Well, no doubt. No doubt. Let's not go. Let's not go there. As a non-smoker in the brokerage business, let's just say I was a minority, and not a favored minority.
Yeah, that's right.
Let me tell you. But it was 29 to 32 was a living memory for all the old timers in who were working in the business back then. And so you know, there was kind of a anticipation, oh, this is going to happen again. And that was part of the reason why that got went so bad so fast. We did not have a recession after that.
I know.
To the shock of everyone. And I kind of see this as a similar situation, because I don't see with the kind of stimulus that we are pumping into the economy, particularly with the big beautiful bill, the BBB as people are calling it, I just don't see a near-term recession particularly from policy error, but I can see that those two markets getting out of whack, and I'm kind of watching that right now.
I think that's a reasonable concern. I share your position on recession too. You know, between 85 and 90, we had a situation that was affectionately referred to as the rolling recessions. Various sectors or various parts of the economy, regions of the economy would suffer greatly, but the overall economy maintained positive growth. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's what we see mm-hmm. going forward.
I agree. And but getting back to your first answer, yeah, I think a breakdown of the U.S.-China relationship is the biggest threat out there in the near term. I mean the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, if you think about it, China is really the only peer competitor the United States has. And, you know, if you look at with the administration's trade negotiations, they're getting lesser powers to cave. You know, the Vietnamese caved. Right now, we're watching South Korea and Japan. It's quite possible by the time this comes out, that will be resolved. It may not be resolved ideally, but it probably will. But China can push back. And that's why I rated it as the biggest issue over the next 3 years.
Well, we've already seen that on the rare earths distribution, mm-hmm. haven't we?
Yes.
You know, they have a lot of levers that they can pull if they want to get nasty.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the second question. How have tariffs, both real and threatened, impacted your buy-sell process? How does Confluence separate out the hyperbole from the actual policies? Will this administration continue to delay implementation of tariffs with key trading partners like China and Europe, or do we anticipate new trade agreements over the summer? First off, the way that I have been framing the whole tariff situation is part of President Trump's management of his coalition. He has a widely diverse and broad political coalition that he has stitched together, some of which are free traders, some of which want to see significant barriers enacted, some of which want only sectoral tariffs. And he's trying to manage that. And so the way I view it is that he makes a very broad statement like the ones we saw, the reciprocal tariffs we saw in the first quarter. And then he watches the reaction and then he adjusts. And so far, he hasn't really dug in on anything, but back away, we're probably going to end up with a universal tariff, a floor of 10% and a ceiling probably somewhere between 20 and 25% overall. Some areas of the world will get hit harder than others. The ones with less power will probably suffer more, and the ones with greater ability to push back will probably suffer less. I do think we'll have lots of negotiations. A full-blown trade deal takes years to negotiate. I mean, it tends to run to thousands of pages. But a general framework, I think, will emerge. And, you know, there's lots of room to negotiate. I mean, one of the things we saw in the late 80s with the Japanese was, well, if you build your plants here, we'll cut you some slack. I could easily see that kind of negotiation come through. Mm-hmm.
As far as the buy-sell process going, how's it affected? Well, it's just one more regulatory input. We're used to this. As I've mentioned many times, I grew up in the business by following the electric utility industry, very highly regulated, not just by state regulators, but by federal regulators, EPA, et cetera, Nuclear Regulatory Commission. These people can change your business and your lives very quickly. A lot of businesses are like that. Just ask the health insurers right now with the massive changes to Medicaid that are going on. As equity analysts, this is just kind of stuff we deal with on a pretty regular basis. Is it new? Well, yeah, it's newer than some of these others, but I guess, over the years, you just get, you get blindsided by regulations so often, you just try to not be blindsided anymore. And we all pay very close attention to this stuff.
Well, and the two of us and others here at the firm watch this stuff a lot, and we gather outside help on this as well. It is something that we pay a lot of attention to. In terms of asset allocation, where a lot of this ends up is, we try to avoid the sectors that are being adversely affected. Although, you also keep a gimlet eye on them because eventually they get so cheap that, it becomes a compelling story. You do have to avoid, catching the falling knife. One of the great things about our industry is we have lots of colorful aphorisms for those sorts of things. But it does actually create opportunities too.
Yeah. No, it absolutely does. Whenever a regulatory or legal event occurs that, or tax event that knocks a stock down, hits unexpectedly. And this certainly hit like that. I think we were all looking for tariffs. I don't think very many people on Wall Street were looking for tariffs on everything at 50%, which is pretty close to what we got in early April. And you saw that people weren't expecting that by the market reaction. Right. So, but these kind of things do happen. What you do is you look at that, the market immediately discounts this new regulatory adverse development. And then as an analyst, your decision is the discount overdone? You run your numbers because these are businesses, and you run your numbers. You say, okay, what's the value versus the of the business now? Is it too cheap relative to this negative development, or not? And then with that, and this is particularly important on this, you have to look at the permanence of this adverse regulatory development. Is this temporary or permanent? And that's been the big issue right now. They have been extraordinarily temporary because it's almost as if the negotiating process is being broadcast to the world in real time. So it's kind of tough to tell what's a negotiating tactic and what is a real permanent tariff.
Tariffs are just one element of this, but this is a problem that we've seen evolving now really for the past decade, is that when you get these enormous swings in policy, how do businesses make long-term investments? And, it wasn't that long ago that everything EV was an alternative energy, was where you were going to make money, and fossil fuels were dead. And that's completely reversed, and who knows, it could reverse again at some point. You try to look for the longer term trends, but you simply have to acknowledge that sometimes, I guess the way to think about it is, we went for a long period of time with a general consensus of how things should go. And now we're revisiting that consensus. That's been something we've been talking about here for a mm-hmm. long time, that we've been warning people that the existing order was breaking down and something new is emerging. And when you're in that something new is emerging part, there are missteps and overstretches, and that's just something that you have to deal with.
Absolutely. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, this grand trade deal was about 10 years in the making. By the time it was delivered to Washington around 2015, it wasn't sure it was going to pass. And by 2016, both candidates of major parties came out against it. That was the proof that we're in a new world, and that the trade world that was extant for the previous 40 years or so was changing. Yeah. And we don't know what the new world is going to look like.
No, that's what we're in the process of doing. So the next question is, if you polish off your crystal ball and fast forward to the November timeframe, and you assume we have more facts and clarity on tariffs, budgets, and taxes, what do you believe the economic and market landscape will look like going into 26 and beyond? I do think we'll get some clarity. My viewpoint has been that in broad brushstrokes, is that we're going to see dollar weakness, suppressed interest rates, continued large cap outperformance, and foreign outperformance. This is typically what you see in a modest upward inflation environment. Again, there'll be hiccups and corrections and all through that, but I think that's kind of the direction of travel that I've been expecting.
I agree. We just talked in the previous question about all the changes that are going on, and policy hasn't settled yet. But I think when it does, we're going to see exactly what you said. Weaker dollar, I think, is going to be really hard to overcome. I think that's just the way world we're going to have is a weaker dollar, and that has all kinds of implications: foreign investments, inflation. You know, equity and fixed income investors don't often consider the currency, particularly here in the U.S., because, you know, everything we do is denominated in dollars. You know, we only have two countries next door that have different currencies, and they are highly dependent on us. We just don't think about the currency that much.
Right.
But I think if we're going to think seriously about this and deeply, we've got to look at the impact of the currency.
Yeah, currencies was the first market I analyzed. So in March of next year, it'll be my 40th anniversary of working in the financial markets. And if you look at the long-term chart of any of the major dollar indexes, it's pretty apparent you go through long cycles in currencies. And we've been in an up cycle now for quite a while. And this administration looks like one of its key policies is to bring about dollar weakness. Effectively, we're trying to shift some of the burden of our policy adjustment on foreigners, and one of the ways you do that is through your exchange rate. So everything else that goes along with that. The one thing that I would point out is that, you know, for the past 12, 13 years, we have had a really spectacular outperformance of U.S. equities over foreign equities. And a big supporting factor in that has been dollar strength. And if that does reverse, we would expect at least some degree of reversal in that foreign stock versus U.S. stock relationship as well. This next question is really kind of a deep one. I'd be curious about your outlook on the economy and markets giving declining birth rates, both the U.S. and globally. Also, thoughts on the impact this could have regarding Social Security. So, Mark, why don't you lead off on this?
Okay.
You've been thinking about this a lot.
Yeah, for a long time. And tell you what, let's set the Social Security aside for just a moment, and let's just focus on the first part of that question, which I think is much more important. I realize Social Security benefits are important. I don't mean to imply that they're not, but I think the first part of that is the question is the one that a lot of people don't understand. In my opinion, and I think the opinion of a lot of people, it is virtually impossible to grow an economy without a growing population of consumers. Everyone likes economic growth. But when your population is declining, it becomes very, very difficult to grow. You can export your way out of it for a while. That is, you expand the population of consumers by using other countries' consumers. That works for a while until those other countries get tired of you displacing their manufacturing. It's also nice to have a growing supply of labor, and that helps. Yeah, in a lot of ways too. In particular, growing population of labor means growing population of people with income who, oh, by the way, are also consumers. It's easiest to grow your population of consumers biologically. But we have found in the Western world that is harder and harder to do. And therefore, there's really only one other way to grow the population if your birth rate is below the replacement rate, and that's through immigration. It has been, frankly, one of the secrets of the U.S. economic growth that we've seen over the past several hundred years, is that we have historically done immigration pretty well. But it does come in waves. It ebbs and flows, and government policy has definitely affected this. We have, when you and I were little tykes, Bill, we didn't realize it, but we were at one of the lowest ebbs of immigration in American history. I think only about 5%, maybe less, of the U.S. population was foreign-born back in the 50s. And one of the results of that was labor was really getting tight and expensive. And as a result of that, the union movement was strong. And we were seeing inflation over the next 15, 20 years start to rise. Policymakers decided we needed more people in the country, and so they revised the immigration laws in the 60s, and we started bringing more people in. You know, I try and stay out of whether this is good or bad. This is just the facts. This is what people do. And then when you see the percentage of foreign-born get into the mid-teens, you start seeing pushback from the populace because of usually because, the root is competition. Labor competition. And so then policies start to change and they go the other way. And we've been observing that. In fact, the percentage of foreign born has been approaching 20% of the population. And historically in U.S. history, that hasn't lasted very long. The pushback becomes so strong that policy has changed. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now. I am somewhat optimistic, however, because, and I guess I always am.
Fault of yours.
Yeah. I've said many times, that's why I'm an equity guy. If you're not an optimist, it's hard to be an equity person. But foreigners of whatever ethnicity, religious background, et cetera, tend to have higher birth rates than folks whose families have been in the U.S. for generations. And those higher birth rates are good. Now, can create social discomfort. But again, if you haven't got a growing population of consumers, it's really tough to grow. So this is one of the things, though, that does concern me, is it's, I think almost certainly we're going to see immigration come down. We already are, dramatically and rather fast. And after all, this is one of the big reasons Trump was elected. And he is executing a anti-immigration policy. These new consumers in the country have been additive to consumption, and if we're going to reduce that, our consumption is going to come down. It's going to be tougher to grow. But again, for all the problems we think we're having in this area, other countries are having much more trouble. They're either having no immigration, which is a problem with many Asian countries. So there's no way to fix their demographic problem. None whatsoever, it seems. Or you have countries like the European countries who, frankly, don't do immigration well. They don't assimilate. The U.S. is a remarkable assimilation machine. We call it a melting pot. And it's not a smooth and easy process, but if you look back through our history, it's kind of remarkable.
Yeah, there's really no other country in the world that does it better than us. The British are close, but I've observed the same thing. Once you get north of 15% foreign-born, you start to see problems develop. And one of the issues with immigration is that enough economic studies have shown that it is most likely a net benefit to a country and an economy. The downside is that the benefits and the costs are not equally distributed. Mm-hmm. If you live in a border state, you deal with a lot of the costs of immigration. And if you don't compete with immigrant labor, immigration just makes your life better. Mm-hmm. I will say for cities like St. Louis, immigration has been really positive. The Bosnian immigration wave that we saw a decade ago pretty much saved South St. Louis. Mm-hmm. It went from being in decline to a vibrant recovery with rising real estate values, new businesses, new restaurants, new cultures. It was pretty fantastic. Doesn't always work that way.
No, no.
But I've been just watching this for a while, and I've been telling people that we're getting to a point where traditionally we've gotten a pushback. The other thing I would add is that, you know, for most of my career, I was a commodity analyst, and commodity analysts are known for only focusing on supply. We almost spend no time on demand. And the reason is that commodity demand is usually a function of population growth. Population always grew, so, you know, you can study it, but you do one model and you're usually done, and you use that model until you retire. Falling birth rates are actually starting to skew that a bit, which is really interesting. You know, we don't have experience with falling food demand, and we're not yet. What tends to happen is that as people get richer, they eat more, and they eat more of different things, higher cost food, we're starting to see some early inklings in oil demand that slower population growth is starting to have an effect. Mm-hmm. The demand is starting to flatten out a little bit. These are big changes. And, there's other issues that we talk about in-house. China hasn't fought a kinetic war since the 1970s when they had a border tussle with the Vietnamese. It's now become a country of only children. And we don't know what a country going to war with an army of only children looks like, because if you get the normal level of fatalities, you're wiping out generations of families' hope for their next generation. We just don't know how this goes. The other element that you end up with is that you get a move to automate. You have to automate to maintain productivity because you're getting fewer workers. I think a lot of this discussion around artificial intelligence is being driven by that. Robotic automation too. China is aggressively investing in robotic automation because they are suffering a decline in their population. And, if they're going to replace that labor, they're kind of stuck with using machines to do it as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. I want to underscore what you said about the cost of immigration not evenly distributed. This is, and it's both geographically and class distribution. Someone's complaining that there's not enough immigration because he can't get his lawn and gardens cared for properly, he's in the upper class, and he probably thinks immigration is just fine. And this policy is terrible. On the other hand, if you're in a lower economic classes and you run you're competing against someone who's you're a roofer and you're competing against, it might be a completely different thing. This seems new to people, but it's not.
Right.
You and I are descendants of Irish and Germans, respectively. And there was a time when our ancestors weren't looked on kindly.
Actually, it's still the case.
My grandfather changed his name from Gustav to Gus pre-World War One, during World War One, it was not good to be a German.
That's right.
And so these are not new things, and they're difficult, and we're going through it now. And again, I'm an optimist. I think we'll come out the other side.
Let's wrap this question up with a couple quick notes on Social Security.
Yep.
I think we're both in agreement. We're going to means test it. We're probably going to raise the FICA threshold. Mm-hmm. I've heard talk of creating a donut where, the FICA threshold, let's say, is 200,000, and then you get a break between 200 and 400, and then it kicks back in of incomes above 400,000. You're going to make it less of a good deal, but also still probably try to make it good enough for less affluent households to maintain some semblance of income. So, you know, the old line about this is Bill Gates doesn't need Social Security, and he doesn't. Where it gets tough is that, well, how far down do you go in the income wealth scale before you start taking it away?
I had someone explain to me a number of years ago that the Social Security problem is really a math problem. And it's not difficult math either.
No, it's really not.
It's pretty easy.
Politically
math.
Hard.
It's politically very, very hard. And eventually you get to a place where the politics change. And it may mean that us boomers have to move on to our reward before things change. But I think that's relatively easy. And at one there'll become a time when it is politically feasible. The problem, the tough one, is Medicare, which is almost as big as Social Security, and it isn't easy math. It is extraordinarily complex, and we don't have time in the rest of this broadcast to go on how complex it is, but that to me is going to be a really tough nut to crack, and I'm not sure how it's done, because the two of them together are gobbling up the federal budget at a rapid pace. And until we address both of them, this business about balancing the budget is just talk.
Right. No, that's right. Let's get to the last question of the day. Do we anticipate the Fed to increase, decrease, or hold Fed funds rate during the second half of 25? Are we concerned about the independence of the Fed? Will Powell be renominated? Let's do the last one first. No, there's absolutely no chance in any world that Jerome Powell gets another swing at this. My own contention is we get one rate cut between now and Powell's exit next year, which I believe is in May. And then after that, we see a rapid succession of cuts, probably 5 to 6 quarter point cuts. I think Powell is desperate not to become the next Arthur Burns, and he will stick to that legacy. In terms of that whole anti-immigration thing we discussed earlier, that is going to keep the labor markets tighter than they otherwise would have been and provide cover for him to maintain steady policy. But once we get a new Fed chair in, I think he or she will not be appointed without being a dove. I just don't think there's any way around it. And then finally, are you concerned about the independence of the Fed? Yes, I am. We don't have time to go through it completely here, but one of the reasons you study history is to try to figure out exactly why. And we know what happened. We don't exactly know why it happened. And I'm convinced that what Paul Volcker did was more about giving people faith that policymakers would implement austerity, because up to that point, there'd been no evidence that they would. And if we end up in a situation where the executive branch is dictating monetary policy, even if the Fed is nominally independent, it will be de facto under the thumb of the executive branch.
I got a question for you. What are the odds, actually a two-part question. What are the odds that Trump nominates someone and who he thinks is going to be his Arthur Burns? And much as George H.W. Bush nominated Justice Souter, and it turns out to not be the guy you thought you were getting. Number one, and what would be, that's number one, that's part A. Part B is, what would be the markers that you would look for in seeing how this new Fed chair is going to behave?
Just looking at the people, Kevin Warsh, whose name has been kicked around a lot, I think he would end up becoming a grave disappointment to the White House, that I think he would actually try to maintain the independence of the Fed. And if he felt like there was trouble, he would push back against it. Waller, who's Governor Waller at the Fed, might be that surprise candidate, because he's saying, oh yeah, we need to cut. But he's steeped in Fed world. And I could easily see a situation where he comes in, cuts a couple times, and then says, I think we've done enough. And that's not what the White House wants to hear. So if there's a surprise candidate out there, I think it's probably Waller would turn out to be less compliant than they mm-hmm. expect. I think if they want somebody really compliant, they're going to have to go outside the Fed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, they tried with Judy Shelton, and she couldn't get through the Senate. Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of person.
I agree. I think they're going to be looking for another Judy Shelton. People from inside the Fed, they don't want to be the next Arthur Burns or G. William Miller. They want to be, you know, William McChesney Martin or Paul Volcker, people who stand up to the White House because they think about their legacy. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's going to be a tough one to pull off. They're going to say all the right things, I think, up front.
But that's why you're hearing this talk about have Bessent move over. And it could turn out Bessent surprises them, too. Mm-hmm. But he would be, I think, I'm looking for an outsider. If they stay on the inside, I think they're going to really be disappointed.
Good enough. Yeah, I guess that's a good way to analyze it.
All right, I think we'll wrap up here. Again, as a reminder, if you want to submit a question, send one to mailbag@confluenceim.com. Today's discussion is based upon sources and data believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward-looking statements expressed are subject to change without notice. This information does not constitute a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. Our audio engineer is Dane Stoll.